So I feel like there's something we have not discussed as a podcast crew, which is our nuclear launch protocol.
This is important. This is a big oversight.
So we need to figure out, so for instance, like, who has the nuclear launch authority? Who's going to carry the football?
Wait, there's an antecedent question.
Oh, there is.
Who's like our nuclear targets?
Oh, there's so many.
When Rational Security is going to like launch a nuclear strike, is it like against deep state radio? like who is it that we're trying to take out?
No, it's
against that's a separate discussion.
It's MeUndies.
MeUndies, yes. Okay, so if we're going to launch a nuke on MeUndies, I feel like Susan or Tamara should have launch authority. I feel like I would be comfortable with them.
Because we're the grown-ups in the room.
I feel like they are probably the most trusted.
Not so much an axis of adult as like a straight line of adults. Yeah. What is it when it's two?
I feel like Ben should have the football because like I'm not carrying a bag.
I think Sophia Yan should carry the football.
Well, that's good. But she's in like China, so that's probably...
Yeah, so that'll keep it away from...
Who presses the button, though?
I think we should all do it together.
Yeah, it's just like touching the globe.
Touching that glowing orb. Yeah,
it should require all four of our hands on it.
The glowing orb, which, by the way, has started spontaneously turning itself on.
Yes, that is actually the broken glowing orb that never turned on now mysteriously turns itself on.
It knows. Hello, and welcome to Rational Security, the Mother May I Launch a Missile edition. I'm Shane Harris, trigger-happy reporter. I think that our protocol is a very sound one, you guys.
I think we can avoid inadvertent escalation.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we can do that. I think we have established a protocol.
And I just like to put MeUndies on notice that, you know, sponsorship opportunities are available.
That's right.
It's a really nice company you have.
This need not be a first strike situation.
Yeah. Be a shame if anything happened to it.
I just think we should reject any principle of civilian control of ours.
Yeah.
Look, this is a dictatorship and we all know it. Let's just embrace it.
Most definitely.
What do you call a triumvirate if there are four of us?
A quadrumvirate.
A tetrumvirate.
We're a tetrumvirate.
I like it. I am here with the tetrumvirate in the jungle silo. With Susan Hennessy, Tamara Kaufman-Wittes, and Ben Wittes. Hi, everybody.
Hey, Shane.
Hi.
It is the Tuesday before Thanksgiving. Visions of drumsticks and subpoenas dancing in our heads.
The turkeys are being pardoned as we speak.
The turkeys are about to be pardoned.
Yeah,
right.
Did you see Paul Manafort just changed his name to Wishbone?
I saw that the White House was asking people to vote on which one got pardoned.
Don't they both
like, kind
get
of
pardoned?
Sick?
What's
I thought they
that?
Both got pardoned.
Are they going to cut the head off of the loser like right there? I know it's a reality show presidency in some degree. This is kind of taking things too far.
Indeed.
This week on the podcast, speaking of nuclear protocol, should the president have the sole authority to launch nuclear missiles? We know he has the authority to pardon turkeys, but what about
should he have
nuking
the authority
turkey?
To pardon turkeys?
President Trump, you remember him, designates North Korea a state sponsor of terrorism. I guess we should say redesignates. We'll talk about that in the second segment. And the grown-ups in charge of national security are exhausted. It's been a long year.
And calling each other idiots.
Fools! All right, let's talk about the United States nuclear protocol. Congress took this question up in a hearing this week, and also Richard Betts and Matt Waxman wrote an intriguing piece for Lawfare on this question of whether or not the president, when it comes to a first strike, that is to say, we're not launching nuclear missiles because someone has attacked us with nuclear missiles, but a first use of nuclear missiles against a target, whether the president should have the sole authority to order that launch as he does now, or whether or not he should have to go through some kind of procedural check and kind of executive branch sign off with various officials. And we'll talk about those proposals look like. But first, let's talk about like what is the basic case for why the president shouldn't have the sole authority to launch a nuclear first strike. Ben, why don't you talk about that? And is this question being raised because of the particular moment that we're in, or is this something that has come up in previous administrations, questions that have been asked?
So the question has always been there. And it's always been, you know, a feature of the presidency since the 50s that made people a little bit nervous. And the origins of strike, centralized presidential strike authority, was that It actually came from the Eisenhower administration, where you had all of these field commanders who had potential access to nuclear weapons. And there was this understanding that developed that, gosh, you know, we're in kind of end the world territory. And you don't want every general in the field to have the ability to make a decision that's going to end the world. That's not just simply a choice of weapon, right? It's a choice of escalation to the point of you know, potentially civilization-ending conflict. And so if somebody's going to do that, it should only be the commander in chief. And so there was a very deliberate decision to pull all the authority to conduct, to order the use of nuclear weapons into the hands of the president himself. Now, there are both constitutional questions, reasons why that may be hard to regulate, but also prudential reasons, i.e. when you decide to use a nuclear weapon, it's presumably because you're in a crisis that requires nimbleness and you know, a sudden decision to do something like that. And so it is one of the reasons it has persisted over the years is that we have trusted presidents a little bit more than we have trusted the bureaucracies that sometimes surround them, and as well the bureaucratic mechanisms that you could imagine to restrain them. And I think what's changed over the last year is that that is certainly not true right now. And so when you have a president who's as mercurial and peculiar and clinically symptomatic as this one, you begin to wonder about unilateral authorities that don't have checking mechanisms.
So I think that one of sort of the it's interesting to see, you know, we're actually revisiting this kind of for the second time of the Trump presidency. Remember, we talked about this a lot sort of at the end of August. Ben, you and I had actually written an article about it, sort of as Trump's very, very heated rhetoric about North Korea. This is the fire and fury sort of had people especially worked up about the issue. What I'm seeing now is a lot of people sort of expressing a belief that the president has unchecked lawful authority to nuke anyone anywhere at any time. That strikes me as a little bit of an overstatement.
So
assuming that we're in the world where there's not imminence, so either you know, we're not under the conditions in which a nuke has actually been launched at us, and so it's sort of it's not a first strike, and also, you know, it's not, we don't think that a potential strike is imminent, right? We're really out of the realm of imminence. I'm really talking about, you know, the pure first strikes. There is a set of sort of lawful targets and there's unlawful targets that under both domestic and international law that, you know, if it's, you know, he can't nuke England or, you know, Japan just because he feels like it. If it's, you know, under international law, if it's, you know, a resort to force that's non-defensive and it's a non-defensive use of military force under domestic law.
Well, I mean, if there's no imminent threat, a first strike is unlawful, even against North Korea.
Right. So really what we're talking about and all of these sort of these legal provisions and constitutional amendments is not about constraining the president's actual authority. It's about ensuring some kind of procedural check in the event an irrational president ordered an unlawful strike. What we're lacking now is not sort of the conditions of, well, is this, you know, can he do whatever he wants? Are there constraints? But is there a way to bake into the procedure some kind of check on, hey, is this a crazy person? Is this lawful? That's the piece that's missing.
So I agree that that's the focus of the policy conversation. But I think that the fact that that's the focus of the policy conversation spotlights why we're having the conversation right now, which is that this is a president that too many people do not trust to follow the law or even to care what the law says or what the law requires or does not permit. And if we didn't feel that way about the president, we wouldn't be talking about having procedures to check that power is being lawfully exercised. So that's the first thing. The second thing, though, is that I think there's a reason why this decision, this nuclear authority, you know, comes up kind of regularly at moments of national anxiety. It's kind of a cultural meme, whether it's, you know, the hunt for Red October at the height of the Cold War, or more recently, I guess that movie Salt also had a scenario of stealing the president's authority to launch nukes. And it's because these weapons are, you know, the ultimate power that the United States can deploy. They carry with them, the prospect of their use carries with them a sort of eschatological dimension. Mm-hmm. You know, that these could bring about the end of the world, that once you cross that threshold, there is no going back. And I think that anxiety about the state of the world, not just who our president is part of what's contributing to this question coming up again right now. This is a moment where not just Americans, but a lot of people around the world are anxious about disorder. They're anxious about accidental conflict. They're anxious about escalated conflict. And so this is coming up again.
Let's talk about a specific proposal, which I found really interesting that Betts and Waxman put on Lawfare, which is, okay, what if we required that for a first strike, not for any kind of crisis scenario in which the missiles are flying, or I guess we think there's about to be an imminent launch, that the president would have to get certification from the Secretary of Defense or his designate that the order is valid, in other words, that it's actually coming from the president, and I presume there'll be other factors to judge validity in that, which is important because the protocol is designed to ensure, in fact, that it is the president giving the order and not someone impersonating him, and that the Attorney General or a designate would have to decide whether the strike is legal. So, I mean, Ben or Susan, maybe tackle this for me, just from a procedural point of view. How does that strike you as a possible solution? I mean, I can imagine the criticism of it will be that this will take far too long. This will become more of a public action than a kind of a surprise attack, maybe, that you would presume one would want if you're about to use a nuclear missile, or maybe you wouldn't. But does that strike you as a viable mechanism for inserting some kind of check? And also, why should we believe that these two people won't just go along with any president's order?
Well, so, look, I mean, I think if you're talking about a circumstance of a first strike, in order for the first strike to be lawful, in order for the Attorney General to make that certification, it would have to be in a circumstance of imminent threat.
Right. That's a baseline, right? And that's important.
You're not allowed to just, like, nuke somebody in the absence. By the way, under domestic law, you're not allowed to do it because that's a, you know, resort to force, not in self-defense, right? So that's not within the president's inherent authority. You can't do it without congressional authorization.
And we should stipulate, and a first strike is grave, bordering on crazy in the first place, but go ahead.
And in international law, it's a violation of the UN Charter to just attack somebody, a country.
Yeah, no one ever violates the UN Charter.
So no one ever violates, it is true that countries violate the UN Charter, but they generally claim when they're doing it that they're acting in self-defense.
Right, and a president would generally claim that they're engaged in preemptive self-defense by carrying out a first strike.
Right. So the real question here is, president decides in a first strike situation, and not, you know, which is to say, not so exigent that we think somebody's already launched against us. Right. That, okay, we need somebody to get this certification. First of all, I don't think that certification is going to be, unless it's really crazy, that difficult to get. Because most of the time, if you're at a stage of international tensions where you're contemplating a nuclear strike, right? You can colorably say it's self-defense. You're doing it because you think they're preparing to strike you or something. So my assumption is that this is probably a doable thing, that it's not but that it also wouldn't actually do that much, in the sense that, okay, yes, you would say the president has decided he wants to nuke Iceland tomorrow. He's not going to be able to get Jeff Sessions to certify that that's legal. But I don't really think that that's the risk, right? The risk is that the president too impulsively, too soon decides to actually escalate against North Korea. And in the circumstance in which you're contemplating attacking a nuclear power that is in fact threatening to attack you, you're probably going to be able to get your attorney general to certify what you want. And your secretary of defense is probably going to certify that, you know, it was really you that said it. So
So it's not really a constraint at all, is what you're saying.
Well, I'm not sure about that, but how much work it's really going to do.
Let me ask you this way. I mean, maybe this is a way of getting more, that's sort of the meat of this question and perhaps the particular anxieties that are making it come up now, which is, let's say, hypothetically, the president decided as some kind of punitive measure or for reasons other than imminence, decided, or maybe it's imminence in his own mind, I'm going to nuke Pyongyang. This is just what we have to do. We've got to do it. Do we believe that the people around him and the mechanisms that they represent would move to constrain him? Even, you know, whether it's something like the military saying this is an unlawful order, we won't
follow it. Paul
Ryan
would say he's very concerned.
Well, it's a legitimate question. When we start talking about this, it naturally raises questions of, are we moving into the idea of a coup or somehow people like physically blocking the president or don't execute the coup? But like, do we think this president or another? I mean, we're talking a little bit here about a kind of a madman scenario. Do we think the mechanisms around him are sufficient that they would say this is completely ill-advised and we're not doing it?
Right. So I think it's sort of necessary to put it in context. And Garrett Graff has a really good piece from, I don't know, back in July or something at this point, sort of about the history of, sort of launch orders and constraints. And he makes the important point that, look, this 4-minute time dimension was sort of in an age before nuclear capability. Submarines, at a point at which actually, the ability to respond was time limited. You only had X amount of time, or else an adversary could, in theory, destroy your capacity
before
to retaliate. And sort of completely gone now. and so these time constraints are essentially artificial. They're super artificial in the context we're talking about, in which it's a genuine sort of first strike. So I think that a lot of these proposals are about building in time and building in people, right? So you're imagining
a more considered decision.
Exactly. So you're imagining the scenario in which Trump really, really impulsively is doing something. And maybe there's an open question about lawfulness, but it's just kind of crazy on its face. If what you wanted was for that decision to not occur without sort of impinging on the president's constitutional authority, I do think a reasonable strategy is to say, okay, how can we slow it down? To ensure that these other mechanisms have time to sort of take root? And how do we, you know, sort of ensure that there are grownups in the room, right? Who are the other actors that we're going to want to independently certify sort of under their, you know, and ask them to do so in their own official capacity so they have independent obligations to not just be the president's yes man, but to say, yes, we are certifying that we believe X, Y, and Z are true. It is obviously responsive to sort of the, I don't know, peculiarities of Trump's, I don't even know how to describe it at this point, instincts or impulsiveness. Mm-hmm. But I do think that's a reasonably calibrated strategy and one that, should that situation actually emerge, probably has a reasonable possibility of working.
You know, I feel like it's of a piece with other attempts we've seen initiated from within the cabinet to slow roll through process presidential decisions that folks in the executive branch have reason to think are more impulsive, less thought through, perhaps unconstructive. Like, you know, whether we're talking about the second round of the travel ban or the transgender military ban, which I think the Defense Department very successfully kind of wrapped in cotton through a process that is so lengthy that it may never end. And there's something to be said for that in terms of kind of ensuring that impulsivity doesn't reign. But when I step back from policy world and I think about it from the perspective of an American somewhere wanting their government to do things for them and wanting to feel like the people that they elected have the capacity to actually make changes on their behalf. Those sorts of institutional process-based, slow-rolling solutions actually undermine public trust in government. They undermine public trust in institutions, and they make people frustrated. And so I recognize the value of them in the moment for solving particular problems, but I worry about the impact overall.
Yeah, and I just want to say a lot of these proposals, and I think the one that we published this week is the most sophisticated of them that I've seen. They are Band-Aid attempts to deal with a problem that is actually going to be resistant to Band-Aids, and that is having a president whose mental health you sufficiently question that you want to limit his authority. And the real answer to that problem is to elect people whose mental healths and oaths of office you take more seriously.
Oh, that'll fix everything.
Stop electing crazy people. We won't have to worry about this anymore.
All right. Let's move on to our next topic. President Trump has redesignated North Korea a state sponsor of terrorism in a move that I think is generally being seen as obviously a response to its nuclear weapons development program and potentially paving the way for further sanctions of the country. Tamara, first explain why this is North Korea is kind of going back on the list, but also, I mean, how significant of a move is this? Because I think a lot of people were skeptical yesterday that this was really going to change the calculus all that much with respect to North Korea and how the U.S. or any other country can prevent it from developing its nuclear weapons capability.
Yeah, so this is a list that's kept by the State Department of state sponsors of terrorism. The other countries on the list are Iran, Sudan, and Syria. And North Korea had been on the list, I think, from the late 80s. But then when President George W. Bush was engaged in the last round of nuclear negotiations with the North Koreans, they took the North Koreans off the list. So the redesignation is based essentially on the fact that North Korea has engaged in assassinations on foreign soil, including notoriously the use of a chemical to assassinate Kim Jong-un's half-brother in an airport in Manila, was it?
Yeah. Crazy.
Kuala Lumpur.
Bond villain style crazy.
Yeah, very, very colorful assassination.
Caught on tape,
right. And so, you know, that's certainly a reasonable basis for designation, but I think that counterterrorism experts have raised some questions both about whether it's a sufficient justification, but also whether the designation is actually very useful politically in the current circumstances. I mean, it seems to me that what we've seen in the last couple months is the administration pivot very hard and without acknowledging it from a sort of, we don't want negotiations, there's no way to solve this problem other than through coercion kind of approach to coercive diplomacy, which is we will use threats and sticks to drive North Korea back to the negotiating table. And this is meant as a stick. You know, in other words, we're going to punish you, but then we can always take it away if you play nice at the negotiating table. So it seems that that's the underlying kind of policy logic. The question is whether it actually can have that effect in practice. Dan Benjamin, who was a colleague of mine in the State Department, he was Secretary Clinton's coordinator for counterterrorism, really feels like the designation doesn't add anything to the existing sanctions on North Korea, which are about as severe as we can make them, but also not particularly effective given how isolated the North Korean economy is from the world and North Korea is generally from the world. So it doesn't add any concrete tools to our arsenal to increase the pressure. It's more a symbolic move. And then that raises the question, does North Korea care that it's on the state sponsors of terrorism
list?
And
doesn't it, like, not to, like, you know, make this, just reduce it to, like, schoolyard taunt, and be like, we kind of look like chumps if we're just throwing that around, and I'm going to put you in the nuclear, in the state terrorism.
Well, exactly.
So,
right.
I mean, why? So it doesn't that diminish our credibility by doing it?
So if the underlying policy logic is coercive diplomacy, that we use threats and pressures to drive them to the negotiating table, this looks an awful lot like an empty threat. And yes, I would agree, it undermines our credibility.
I mean, do you worry at all about sort of the potential ramifications of the hypocrisy, or I guess the inconsistent approach, right? So if they're going to be designating North Korea on the grounds of assassinating individuals on foreign soil.
Yeah, we don't know any other countries that have done that right? that aren't on the list. Right?
Most notably, like, the Russians, right? There's their activity in Ukraine, their activity even in the United Kingdom. You know, there's been some documented cases. So,
also using chemicals.
Right. So what does it mean whenever we come up with a list that is both under-inclusive and also potentially over-inclusive whenever you look at countries like Sudan, you know, that do all kinds of terrible things but maybe do not qualify as sort of sponsors of terrorism at this point? Is your sense that it sort of it guts the meaning of the list, or are we already sort of in the category of it doesn't do much and so it doesn't matter and it's symbolic?
But we've always had this problem. I mean, Qatar is an active sponsor of Hamas, and we don't designate Qatar, right?
Israel has carried out assassinations on foreign soil, reportedly, and we don't designate Israel.
Right, I think Israeli actions are probably closer in character to the kinds of actions that the United States itself takes, which is to say they target military enemies, not political opposition. Whereas...
But my point is much simpler, which is that we've never before designated a country simply for carrying out assassinations. And there are other countries that have carried out assassinations that we are not going to designate on that basis.
Right. But there are also... But even if you restrict the point to pure terrorism... There are plenty of countries that are actively engaged with pure terrorist groups that we don't designate on that basis, because the state sponsor of terrorist lists is not a list of all countries that sponsor groups that in our judgment are terrorist groups. It's a list of countries. All of countries that sponsor terrorist groups that we decide to put on the state sponsor
or that have
list.
Particularly targeted us. It's always been a short list, and I think that that's one way of trying to constrain the hypocrisy problem that afflicts the United States with all of these sorts of designations. But I think the broader issue is, you know, to what extent, and this isn't just about the state sponsors list, but in general, to what extent are we now in a place where we're just labeling as terrorists, you know, things that we don't like, actors that we don't like or behaviors that we don't like. We're using the T word just the way policymakers and politicians, you know, stick the phrase national security into something as a way of saying this is important. Are we now sticking the word terrorism on things as a way of saying they're really, really bad? And I think that more than hypocrisy is actually the danger here.
So I'm curious, and our colleague Deanne Bynum has sort of raised this question as well, and I'm curious for your thoughts, particularly Tammy. This notion that a sponsor of terrorism is a binary thing, right? You either are this thing or you are not this thing, as opposed to know there is a spectrum of relatively complex activity. And so actually any approach that's sort of just designated on or off is probably going to be flawed at its core. I mean, do you think this is even a reasonable approach at the outset to sort of say we can put people into these types of categories?
I don't... Yeah. Again, you know, there's the symbolic dimension, sort of sticking a label on a country. But at bottom, this is a policy tool, okay? A designation as a state sponsor opens the door to particular types of U.S. activity, sanctions. And, you know, and so it's a tool and you can use it. Is it a useful tool in a given circumstance? That should be the policy question. It's not an analytical judgment. It's not a moral judgment. It's a policy tool. And I think that's that's the best way to think about it. And I think that also helps address the hypocrisy question, because the United States is a country with its own interests for which it doesn't need to apologize. And it's going to use its policy tools on behalf of its interests.
Right. On the other hand, I do think there is an argument that these sorts of designations are at their best when they comport with a reasonable assessment of reality.
And that's part of what makes them more or less effective.
Right.
Yes.
And so, you know, the counterexample here is the State Department Human Rights Report, which is, you know, done to a large degree without fear or favor for the countries in question. We slam our allies in it every year to the extent that our allies are significant human rights abusers. And the report, as a consequence, has a lot of credibility. And you know, when certain activities, that certain types of designations that the State Department engages in, for example, countries of particular concern on religious freedom that just happen to include all the countries we don't like and not some of the ones that we do like, even though they can be egregiously awful on religious freedom, have a lot less credibility. And the foreign terrorist sponsor designation is, I think, one of those ones that is a little bit more transparently political. And the fact that North Korea, which despite its myriad sins, of which are, you know, voluminous and terrible and, you know, without parallel in the rest of the world, is not a great state sponsor of terror, including that on the list, feels a little bit like, you know, sort of throwing a grapefruit at them.
Yeah. I mean, I guess when I saw the news of the designation, my first thought was George W. Bush's Axis of Evil speech. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it strikes me that if we had a president whose words meant something more as policy statements, then they might be able to achieve this symbolic punch, this grapefruit throw, without using a concrete tool like the state sponsor list. He could just call them the Axis of Evil, right? He could knit them together into a narrative of bad behavior that's bad for international security, and that's why other countries should work with us in combating this. You know, and you could get the moral suasion and you could get the symbolic power, but we don't have a president whose words are meaningful. In fact, we don't have a president that we can rely on to use words in a coherent manner on behalf of our policy goals. And so we are stuck with resorting to these kinds of blunt instruments.
All right. Well, that's a nice, interesting pivot to our third topic.
Blunt instruments.
Well, president and his words, or maybe even more precisely, the National Security Advisor's words. BuzzFeed had a very interesting story this week, citing multiple sources that over a dinner in July with the CEO of Oracle, the big tech company, H.R. McMaster, the National Security Advisor, trashed Donald Trump, variously calling him an idiot, a dope, and with the intelligence, quote, of a kindergartner. There were about 5 sources for this, and then a 6th source said he was not familiar with the details of that dinner, but said that McMaster had made similarly derogatory comments about Trump's intelligence to him in private. Putting aside here the question of Trump's intelligence, which we've talked a lot about on the podcast before, but you know, this story, and you couple it with the story about Rex Tillerson in an exasperated moment saying the president was a moron.
I believe it was a fucking moron.
Well, yes, it was.
We can say that. We're on a podcast. We're not under FCC rules.
It raises the question, I think, for some people, and certainly did for me. It's like, okay, let's presume for sake of argument that these stories are accurate. I have great faith in the accuracy of the NBC story, the BuzzFeed story just came out, but I have no particular reason to doubt it based on conversations that I've had with people in the administration. Why are these guys hanging around? It raises the question of if these are the grown-ups, right? Tillerson, McMaster, Mattis is in that category too. I mean, if they really feel this way, why are they hanging around and how much longer can we expect them to?
So I'm not quite willing to accept your premise that this is accurate. So I think that the way to describe this story is 4 or 5 sources said that one participant at this dinner that they were not a party to told them that McMaster used the language. So it's like it's very
and
attenuated
another source
sourcing.
who said he was at the dinner said on the record this was not said. Right?
So has McMaster, and so has and the individual Safrakats who this who the CEO of Oracle who purportedly said this to other people has gone on record saying not only did McMaster not say it at the dinner, I never told anybody that he said that at the dinner. Okay. So I think that sort of it also raises questions of Ezra Cohen Watnick, the former NSC director of intelligence, who was ousted under extremely negative terms with H.R. McMaster, is now at Oracle. So there's a lots of reasons to sort of be really suspicious about, is this a hit on McMaster? That said, it does raise sort of the secondary question of, does anyone actually not believe that H.R. McMaster thinks Donald Trump is an idiot with the intellect of a kindergartner?
Yeah, if he didn't say it in this dinner... first of all, it doesn't mean it's not true, and it doesn't mean he doesn't think it. So I think Shane's question actually still stands.
No, I agree, right? So it's sort of like it does, we're back to, we're a year post-election. These people have sort of been through the ringer. They're still fighting off these weird, assaults from whoever, the Bannon camp. Why are they still around? Has their sort of thesis been borne out of, having these rational adults in the room is going to keep us all on course? I have to say, if I were McMaster, if I were Mattis, I would have left a long time ago at this point.
So I have less of a sense of McMaster because he has to be in the immediate proximity of the president, and that strikes me as a different order. But I think, Mattis can congratulate himself honestly that he has performed an immense public service. And I don't think Tillerson can, because he's the collateral damage in Tillerson's case is destroying the State Department. But Mattis, over the year that the Trump administration has been in office, Mattis has actually protected the Defense Department from any serious damage, that none of the crazy stuff. He has made progress on his principal policy priority, which seems to be the defeat of ISIS. And he has largely kept himself out of the craziness that is the Trump administration, the scandals, the insanity. And so I think if you're at least for that member of the axis of adults, I think it's all positive, actually. And there, yes, there have been embarrassing moments. Yes, there have been things that I'm sure he cringes when he thinks about. But is the country better off because of Jim Mattis's service in the Defense Department? I just don't have any doubt of that. And I think if I were him, I would go to sleep every night saying there's not much I can do, but at least I can protect the Defense Department, and I'm show up for work with pride every day.
I think there's probably a lot that we don't know about decisions that have been forestalled or reversed or prevented or whatever, and not just in the Defense Department. So I think the full story is going to come out over years and years from now. And it may be that there are other heroes that we could point to then. But I think that what's interesting about Mattis is that he's the one who, from his very first meeting with President-elect Donald Trump, set a tone where he, said to his face, I disagree with you about these things. And Trump came out in public after that meeting and said, we sat down and we disagreed about these three things, and I still really like this guy. And so I think Mattis was able to declare his independence right at the beginning and exercise it every day. I think Tillerson never declared his independence, came in with some bizarre sense of his purpose, which he is actually executing, but it's horrifically bad for America's national interests. And then Kelly and McMaster, I think, are in a different category because they're serving in the White House. Kelly, in his own personal views on some of these political and policy questions, actually seems to be closer to the president than some people were willing to acknowledge up front, although I think it was pretty clear. And he has proven himself a very willing political adjutant to this president. And McMaster, too, although he's in uniform, and so we've talked on the podcast about how much leeway he actually had to refuse this assignment, but he has been willing to go on TV and defend the president and the president's approach and the president's policy beyond what he's strictly required to do. And that may be the pressure that comes with serving directly in the White House, but I think that those two guys have implicated themselves in ways that Mattis has never done.
I mean, it is sort of interesting to take stock at the end of, you know, sort of the first year, including that transition period, and think about who is still standing, right? So I think earlier on we talked about the probability or possibility that we would not make it to a year one, like January 20 marker, without a major national security resignation, right? That somebody
Michael
high
Flynn.
Level.
We got in right away.
But if you think about it, right, three weeks, Flynn's out. Katie McFarlane, someone who not very
remember
many people
her?
Believe,
oh, yeah.
was all that qualified. Gorka, right? So all of these people that were sort of the some of the ugliest elements or the worst sort of parts of Trumpism that had infected the national security community, actually large portions of them have been forced out of the administration, and kind of the people who were those sane moderate types are still standing. And so sort of I wondered, separate and apart from which policy or security decisions have been won or lost over the course of the year, whether or not we can sort of say, well, this group of people is still there, and there's evidence that kind of the worst is getting pushed out. Tammy looks skeptical.
I'm not optimistic. I guess I would agree with you that some of the worst of the worst have exited, but I don't think that means that we are out of the woods.
The second worst of the worst is not that great.
All right, let's move on to a great thing, a happy thing. We're going to do special object lessons today. It's Thanksgiving. It's almost Thanksgiving. And our objects today are going to be things that we're thankful for.
In honor of Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
Wait, what?
Yes.
Sarah Huckabee Sanders yesterday made all the reporters in the White House press corps say something that they were thankful for
Shut
before
up.
She would take their question.
And the first totally reporter answered this. The First Amendment.
Oh my God, she's such a mom.
Yeah.
All right, Ben, what are you thankful for?
I am thankful for a reporter, speaking of reporters, at the Houston Chronicle named St. John Barnard Smith, who.
It's a good name.
It's a good name. And I met St. John virtually on Twitter, actually quite literally during Hurricane Harvey, when he was wrote a story about organizations that were doing actual relief and were not shyster organizations. And I tweeted it out and tried to draw people to his reporting on organizations that were actually doing real stuff in Houston. And the other day, he, from an antique store in Houston, tweeted at me a picture of a not-so-baby cannon, which has come to be named Uncle Cannon, that he had found in this antique store, and actually a huge number of baby cannons as well, antique baby cannons. And so he on my behalf bought me Uncle Cannon. Aww. And dropped it in the mail, and it is now gracing the file cabinet of my in my office.
It's an impressive cannon.
I hadn't even seen it yet.
It's large and brass, and it is not operable, so we are not going to be firing it.
Uncle Cannon has retired.
Uncle Cannon, it is a retired cannon, and it
stately.
It met Baby Cannon the other day, and on the show page you can see for size comparison, Uncle Cannon hovering over Baby Cannon protectively. A big shout out to St. John, and many, many thanks.
Susan, you want to go next?
I will go next. I have two. So I am grateful to the members of the civil service and intelligence community that are still showing up for work every day. I know this has been a difficult, demoralizing, exhausting, absurd year. And I just think we should all take a moment to think about the people who have decided to stick it out on behalf of their country and express our gratitude. And I am thankful to all of you because this has been the fucking craziest year. And sitting down
the
for
fucking
one
craziest
hour,
year?
In the words of Rex Tillerson, the fucking craziest year. And sitting down for an hour a week has helped preserve my incredibly fragile sanity. And so I am grateful for our merry bunch in the Jungle Studio.
As are we. We're grateful for you too.
So I was away last week, as you know. I spent the week in Boston with visits to both Brandeis and Tufts. And so I'm really grateful for the students that I met there. And particularly, it was really heartwarming to meet a bunch of student listeners to Rational Security. But, you know, it's been a year where I think we've spent a lot of time talking and I've spent a lot of time thinking about the impact of this current insanity on those who aspire to careers in national security. And you know, I've also talked about a lot the kind of struggles for greater diversity and inclusion in national security. And it was great to spend a week with these energetic, accomplished, inspiring students who want to have their own careers in national security and foreign policy, and to know that you're out there listening to the show. So we actually have people that we're talking to when we sit in the Jungle Studio and talk to one another. So thanks to all of you for listening, and thanks for being awesome.
I am thankful for my mom,
Carol Harris. So we're thankful for your mom, too.
She's on a fundamental level. Because without mom, there's no me. Mom just got back from a cruise, actually, a transatlantic cruise. She spent 2 weeks on a boat.
Wow.
It's a long time on a boat. Yep. In the library, they had a copy of my first book, too. So she was, like, texting me from there, and she thought that was so cool.
How many people on that boat do you think she showed that book to?
Oh.
Was like, that's my son.
Apparently, she and my aunt, like, literally had, like, a picture of me on the iPad, and were going around and showing people and comparing
that's
it
awesome.
To all of it.
What's an iPad for, if not that?
Right? It's love. She's like, she gets a commission check. But I specifically want to say that I'm thankful for her, because when I read these stories of men behaving in a most appalling and frankly bordering on criminal fashion in many cases, I know that my mother raised me right, because I have not lost my capacity for outrage. And I know how to recognize that behavior for being wrong and how people can overcome it. So my mom was, she worked a lot. She wasn't home for much of the time when we were growing up, but was a very successful business person, became a really important executive in many lines of work, and had to deal with a lot of the kinds of things that I think we're probably seeing right now, but was a tremendous mentor to other women and people who she worked with, and really gave many people a start in their careers that they might not have otherwise had. And I think instilled both in me and my brother a respect for, number one, professionalism and what it means to be a business person, and particularly a business owner, which she became, but also how to treat people fairly and be good to people. So I just know that when I read these stories, and it kind of summons the outrage and the concern and the empathy that I have, that my mama raised me right. So thanks, Mom.
Here's here.
Thanks, great Shane's job. Mom.
Yeah. All right. I got through it. That brings us to the end of the podcast. A special Thanksgiving edition of Rational Security, which is a production, as always, of Lawfare. You can find our Twitter feed at RATL Security. You can find us on Facebook. You can find our show archive at SpaghettiOnTheWallProductions.com. Still
there. We're going to take it down eventually.
Hanging out.
We're getting around
to it. We just haven't gotten around to it yet.
It's a year-end. It's a New Year's resolution. When you download the podcast, please make sure to leave us a nice rating and review. We really appreciate your constructive comments. Our audio engineer this week is Vanessa Sauter. Our show is produced and edited by Jen Patia. Music this week by Donald Trump and the First Strike Sextet.
All right.
Yeah, I'm not in love with that one, Shane.
I'm not in love with it either. But, you know.
I mean, it could be
who
like.
Who are they?
I think it's like
the Attorney General on Kazoo, the Secretary of Defense on Bassoon.
No,
it's not a sextet that goes well together.
I think music this week is by First Strike. It's a metal band.
First Strike. I did just think Donald Trump and the First Strike, which is probably what I should have gone with. Was my first thing. Yeah.
I think First Strike is a metal band.
Yeah, I think so. Sophia Yan, who actually plays her music, probably would kill in a metal band. She would be awesome on the keys. On behalf of my friends Susan Hennessy, Tamara Kaufman-Wittes, and Ben Wittes, happy Thanksgiving, everybody. I'm Shane Harris. We'll talk to you next week. Thanks for listening.